The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
As your parents learned when they dropped you off today, what happens in college stays in college. Most of the time.
When you're scared, when you don't know what's happening to you, you just stay there and you hope that you don't die.
Sex was never part of that friendship. And if we were ever going to be introduced, when I was awake would be a good time for that.
On college campuses, it is not the person jumping out of the bushes or in the parking lot who is going to rape or sexually assault you. It is the person whom you know, the person you may have classes with, the person you see at a party. You think about, it's, you know, the people that we don't know that we should be worried about, but it's really the people that you do know that you should be worried about.
Hello, and welcome to this Guardian Live podcast looking at sexual assault among university and college students. I'm Leah Green, a video producer at The Guardian. You just heard clips from The Hunting Ground, a US-made documentary about rape and sexual assault on college campuses. The Guardian's been investigating similar cases at UK universities, and I want to discuss the issues as they are on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm going to focus on ideas that came up at the Guardian live screening with the Hunting Ground creators, director Kirby Dick and producer Amy Zurig. In the Q&A afterwards, I asked Kirby about the cases they included in the film. The stories often included extreme physical violence, heads being slammed into tiles, strangers grabbing people at parties, or women being drugged and molested in their unconscious state. But not all rapes fall into such categories. Often survivors are left confused as to what's happened to them and say their situation seemed more complicated. Isn't the problem actually bigger when we include what many survivors think of as grey areas? Here's Kirby's response.
I don't like the word grey. I don't like the word gray in this discussion. Yes, there are some, you know, there are the occasional issues where it's complex. But, you know, even in situations where there's no violence at all, there's often, you know, the predator is often aware or should be aware that they're committing a crime. And there is no excuse for that. So I think the word gray actually confuses the issue here. I think it's very fair to say that men don't know they're assaulting. I think it's the minority of cases, but I think it's very frequent. But I still think it's still a crime.
And also, it varies the studies you say, but in certain studies, a large percentage of these crimes, it is clearly a predator-prey relationship, and it clearly is a repeat offender, and it clearly is someone with a modus operandi. And anecdotally, I just heard that over and over and over again. And women don't really know that because they don't trade notes. The perpetrator goes on to do it to another girlfriend. You know, so a lot of the gray, that's, again, I don't know how honestly gray the gray is. And something Camila likes to say, the woman in our film from Harvard, she's like, well, we've all gotten drunk, but we all haven't then sort of, you know, fondled someone else's genitals. Just, whoops, sorry, I was drinking, don't know what I was doing. Like, you kind of know what you're doing, even if you're drunk. You know, it doesn't then make you, you know, violently, you know, assault someone violently or non-violently. And then the other thing I like also to mention, you know, alcohol, because we hear this a lot in the States, it's just alcohol. You know, it's nothing you can do, it's just alcohol. And well, you know, what we actually saw and studies show, alcohol is involved, but it's as a weapon. It's used to incapacitate the victim and embolden the perpetrator. Often in cases, they would say alcohol was involved, but you'll notice that the guy was not drinking as much as the woman. Which is very interesting and more predator-prey than, you know, we both were drinking, we just didn't know what we were doing kind of thing, so.
There are really good reasons to deny that grey areas exist. but I think that it's still useful to talk about what people perceive to be grey areas and why they're seen as grey areas. I asked Karen McVeigh, senior reporter at The Guardian, whether she agrees.
Yeah, the people that I have spoken to, there's a sort of journey that they go on where they wake up in the morning and they're like, what's just happened? What just happened? And they haven't got a name for it, and they kind of like struggle with that. And then they kind of, and then they struggle when they try to tell somebody because of all the perceptions that we have around rape and sexual assault and what consent means. And so I think that what consent classes and the things that university unions are doing are incredibly important. You know, this has got repercussions for sex education in schools, obviously. But, you know, when people begin to talk about these perceived grey areas, what they realise is that they're not grey areas. Mm. They're just things that we know, but when you put it in a real-life scenario, when communication isn't that great, and when you're not clear about the lines of communication, or there's been drink involved or whatever, then people are not as able to specify exactly what's happened to them, whether consent was given or not. I mean, they kind of know that it wasn't, but they're not clear in being able to say this happened and this didn't happen and consent wasn't given and therefore I've been assaulted or, you know, I've been raped.
I made a film for The Guardian called Sex, Lads and Grey Areas, and that was looking at these issues at UK universities. I interviewed a woman called Lucy who was raped by a fellow student in her very first week at university.
It's hard to use words like sexual assault and rape. They seem very big, loaded terms, and it's hard to identify with them. There seems no clear-cut line.
Because words like rape and sexual assault are so loaded, does that make you shy away from them?
The person who did this to me would definitely not have seen it as a rape. I think they had very skewed understandings of what's appropriate and what's not. I think he blamed me. He blamed me for giving the wrong signals, for seeming to promise something that then I wasn't going to deliver on. And had he been slightly re-educated, he might have been a bit more careful.
So, Karen, a lot of survivors have difficulty labelling what's happened to them after the event. You know, there are so many factors that add an air of confusion. It could be that both people were drunk. It could be that you actually went home with the person. It could be that this person is your boyfriend.
I think there are myths around rape that are all to do with, you know, the stranger in the bushes jumping out, the dark alleyway and stuff like that. And a lot of people that I've spoken to talk about how damaging these myths are because it means that when they come forward and say, well, you know, it was my friend that raped me or sexually assaulted me, you know, we were talking, I went back to his room, you know, why? And then all the questions come, well, why did you go back to his room and why didn't you do this and why didn't you do that and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's all these kind of questions that suddenly puts the onus back on them because the people that they're speaking to at university, or a lot of the people that I've been speaking to are students, still in their head they're thinking of these rape myths. One of the women's officers that I spoke to said these are so damaging, these myths are so damaging, and every time she says to a student, you know, you are not to blame, this is not your fault, she gets disclosures about lots of sexual assaults and sexual violence that have happened to people because they are then not afraid to come forward and say, this happened to me, because they're afraid that they will not be believed because we still have these damaging myths in our head. And even though, like, for instance, the CPS has come out with much stronger guidance about what, you know, what consent is and what rape is, and they've said that if you are unconscious or if you're incapacitated by drink, you cannot consent. But yet we are still hearing from victims, from survivors, that they are being met with disbelief and they're being met with kind of people saying, well, you know, is that, I mean, why were you drinking so much and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Just because the CPS has released
guidelines saying if you have drunk this much or if somebody's unconscious. You know, it's about the message getting through, and people need to be able to talk about situations openly. The law and guidelines aren't enough in itself.
And that's why, you know, sex education is so important, that we know from all the research on sex education in schools that it results in better outcomes. Kids have sex later, they have more wanted sex, they use contraception more. The other thing about it is that people become much more aware of the issues, much more aware of what happens, and there's less victim blaming and more support for people who you know, this awful crime has happened to. Mm-hmm.
Sex education isn't mandatory in school curriculums in the UK. It doesn't have to be taught. And this is despite pressure from educators, pressure from students, from pupils, and from MPs from both main parties. In the film Sex, Lads and Grey Areas, we asked some university students exactly what it is that they learnt at school.
My experience of sex education is nothing, basically.
It was mainly just from what my friends, what we kind of learnt growing up, rather than anything that anyone had, like, taught me.
Really, really vague, and generally quite medical, quite biological. So not really talking about the emotional side.
I've never been taught about consent.
We didn't talk about consent.
Consent has never really come up in school.
There's overwhelming international evidence that comprehensive teaching makes young people safer. And yet still, the government is failing to act.
The young people we met in the course of the inquiry were scathing about the sex education they received at school.
Assume they don't know anything. I think that's much more helpful than assuming, well, oh, you're 18, you probably had the birds and the bees talk. And even then, you know, if they had that talk, what was being said?
An audience member at the Hunting Ground film screening brought up the issue of anonymisation of victims of sexual violence.
Hi, my name's Becky. I run a blog called odiarymy.com. Hi. I think that you covered a lot of my questions in the beginning with the whole sort of, like, I felt quite disappointed with the fact that The Guardian always hides the survivor's face. And I thought it was amazing that you guys came out and just had, like, 20 survivors and had that on camera. And I thought that was brilliant because I think it just takes the shame out of it. And I think that in our culture in Great Britain, I'm a survivor. Sorry, I am. No, I'm not sorry. Exactly. But, yeah, like, I always feel, like, ashamed to talk about it. I started a petition in 2010 to advocate for survivors, actually, and I was silenced. And it put a lot of shame upon myself. And I'm an award-winning blogger, and I found it very hard to come back from that. And I think that the fact that you've put this film out there with all these people talking and, like, talking with each other, the women talking amongst each other, I think it's absolutely brilliant. I hope that we can get a lot more survivors on camera so then there's less shame involved in, like, you know, talking about sexual abuse. Really feel like the people on camera were really brave, and I'm really proud they stood up for that.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. Absolutely. I mean, every time we were speaking with a survivor, I think we were both in awe of their courage, articulate they were, how they were really going through their pain again and sharing it with the world because they wanted things to change. I mean, if survivors aren't speaking, if they're not heard and the activists support them, things will not change. And you can tell if a school is doing it right, if they're bringing survivors and activists into the reform process. If they are not, they are definitely doing it wrong.
Really quickly, I can't speak for the whole Guardian at all, but I agree with you, and I think it is really important that the shame is taken out of the issue. And actually, in a couple of weeks, there's going to be a video of a woman speaking about her rape, and she's going to be on camera. And through doing this process, I have realised that there's a lot of shame around it and that we shouldn't be used to seeing silhouetted figures talking about rape. But at the same time, if somebody wants to speak about it, but they will only do it anonymised, I don't want to shut them out and say, sorry, we're all doing it all in the open now. Because, you know, it's a process, but I think films like this will help us get there quicker.
And of course, when we interviewed anybody, we totally deferred to whatever their comfort level was. So we never forced that on anybody. But we realized when we were making the film that we really only wanted to show those that felt comfortable showing their faces, because we wanted for this incident to sort of change people's perspective on it. If you see people talking about it in public, then we want it to sort of show that you shouldn't, that the public shouldn't feel like it's something that can only be talked about in shadow and people should be ashamed of, or there should be a stigma around it. So it's empowering for people to talk about it in a way that they are just coming forward and reporting it. And we should be able to receive it as a public, as a crime like no other, and not feel like there's any shame to it. So that was a carefully, you know, strategic move on our part.
We reached out to hundreds of survivors and we were able to get, I think, nearly 100 agreed, and we interviewed nearly 70 on camera. And I think even though they were initially sort of reluctant, I think the fact that our previous film that we made, The Invisible War, about rape in the military, really had an impact on them, not only in terms of just the fact that they could see how we as filmmakers would handle this, but they could see how that film was received and how much change The Invisible War had caused. So it would be, you know, it's always a difficult decision to go public with something that is so traumatic, but they could see that there would be a real worth to it, a real value to it. It would help inform the public and really hopefully help institutions change so other women and men would not be assaulted.
Karen, in Hunting Ground, what's really striking is that there are so many women speaking non-anonymously about their sexual assaults and rapes. And in the Guardian film, Sex, Lads and Grey Areas, and in most other visual medias I've seen with people speaking about rape, the survivors are anonymised. You know, it was a very conscious decision that the makers of the Hunting Ground didn't want to use anybody anonymously. Do you see the value in that decision, and kind of where do you stand on anonymisation of victims?
It is part of the law that victims of sexual assault are afforded anonymity. Yeah. And if they choose to not be anonymous, that's kind of their right. But we are duty-bound to give them anonymity. And I'm not sure where the law is in the States actually over that. But I think that, I mean, it was a very powerful film. It was really powerful, and partly some of that power was because victims were speaking openly. They were filmed without any kind of shadow or anything like that, and that spoke volumes. And it would be amazing to get to the situation where survivors were not afraid to come forward, or that they felt that they could talk openly about these kind of crimes. But I think part of the reason that they do not is because of victim blaming and fear of not being believed. Only 15% of people come forward to police with their allegations, and the conviction rates are really low. These things are also preventing people from talking about it.
I was thinking about it, and it's a kind of a slight chicken and egg thing, isn't it? Because, you know, there's a culture of shame around rape, and people are embarrassed and don't want to talk about it. And a lot of that is because you don't see people talking about it. But I guess you can't then say everybody has to come forward now and we're not anonymising anybody.
We have to respect people's anonymity. There have been some very brave women who have come forward, students that have come forward, people like Ione Wells, that have come forward to make a very public statement. She started the Not Guilty campaign in Oxford, and that was a powerful campaign, but these are decisions that are up to survivors themselves.
In the Hunting Ground film, a high-profile college sports star from Tallahassee, Florida, is accused of rape.
Poised to play in and possibly win the national championship, a front-runner for the Heisman Trophy Award, Florida State quarterback Jameis Winston now possibly finds himself in some hot water. Winston is part of an ongoing investigation into a sexual assault complaint filed nearly a year ago, but today was turned over to the state attorney.
As soon as I saw this story break, I thought how terribly, terribly unfair it is to this young man.
And I think it's very, very unfortunate that this young dude with this Magic Johnson caliber smile and the level of production and the things that he has done en route to pursuing a national championship and a Heisman Trophy, and now it comes out? It just stinks to me.
Every school in the country that's a big-time powerhouse football team has players dealing with that shit.
As a graduate of one of the colleges that was featured in your film, it really hit home for me. And recently I've been preparing for a speech which I gave this week on the role of sports, professional sports, and the desistance of crime. And as I was doing this research, I came across hundreds of cases of professional sports players who've been convicted of all sorts of crimes, many of them being sexual assault and violent crime. And I was wondering, what role do you think professional sports can play in supporting the progression of these issues? Do you think that that needs to come first, that professional sports needs to take a lead before college sports can respond?
I think they both, I don't know who needs to go first, but I think sports could play a huge role. And the optimistic part is they're structured to, because it's such a hierarchical organization. Like, players listen to their coaches and they get really a lot of guidance and sort of control from their coaches. So it's sort of what we saw in the military. You know, whenever I interviewed people and they said they had a good experience here at this base and a good experience here, and it was just absolutely horrible, I'd say, why? And they said, oh, it was my commander. And that made me realize that the commander really set the climate for the whole atmosphere, whether, you know, the women were treated equally, you know, harassment wasn't tolerated, and people were punished if they went outside the rules. So likewise in sports, I had the same sort of conversations, that if the coach really messaged out in a way and sort of taught the athletes about behavior and boundaries, we found there were lower rates. And in situations where the coaches didn't have the same awareness, consciousness, and didn't exercise the same sort of leadership values, there were obviously athletes that were, you know, would do these things and sort of were protected and covered up by the coaches instead of reprimanded and disciplined. So I think that if we can get coaches involved and sports leadership involved in a way where they not only see the film, but start reframing and re-understanding the consciousness. So the last thing I'll say about that is that after the film opened in LA, I was walking down the street and someone yelled my name and I turned around and it was someone I'd taken exercise classes with, and he said, I have to talk to you. I said, yes. And he said, you know, I saw your film and I was so shook up because I was one of those guys. And I was like, what are you talking about? He says, I was a star athlete in high school. I got recruited to play sports in college. I was Division I athlete. And when the Jameis Winston articles came out, you know, I was watching ESPN and I thought, just like everybody else, oh yeah, you know, he's a liar. She's a liar. Jameis is a good guy. Like, I totally discounted the whole thing. And he said, and then I watched your film and I called my mom right away. And I was like, really shook up. And I was like, oh my God, you know, and I feel so bad. And I said, well, why did you automatically assume that Jameis, that it was? And he said, because our coach taught us in high school that girls were just jersey chasers and that you couldn't trust them. This is messaging from the coach, you know, and watch out. They're just going to try and get something from you. He was a kid. That's what he thought. So you do see that powerful influence a coach can have on someone. And if they're saying something else, you know, it really could transform the culture, I think.
The sports teams, the coaches, the college jock, these are all specific to the US college system. But you can draw parallels with the UK and what we have, which is so-called lad culture. If in terms of the behaviours, the machoism and the competition, but also how some people see them as key to understanding sexism among students. The National Union of Students in the UK says that lad culture, which they also say perpetrates misogyny and rape culture, lays the groundwork for serious sexual violence. For my Guardian film, Sex, Lads and Grey Areas, I wanted to find somebody who identified themselves as a lad.
Do you consider yourself a lad?
Yes. A big lad. I like to do all the lad things.
What are all the lad things?
I like to sleep with as many women, but I don't do very well at it.
Do you chat to your mates? Like, do they give you advice about girls?
No, we just insult each other. I'm a lonely guy. I'm opening up here. I've never said this to anyone. I'm a really lonely person.
Then what's quite interesting is that you never talk to your friends about this stuff, and you're just telling me it all. Do you wish you could talk to your friends about this?
I would like to. Yeah, I would like to talk to people about it, but I just know they won't take me seriously because they know what I'm like.
I don't think lad culture can simply be defined as a clear-cut group of predatory men. This doesn't mean there aren't issues with sexism that need addressing, but it's risky to point the finger at one group and say, we found the problem, especially when it cuts them out of a conversation they need to be part of. Here's Lucy again.
It can be dangerous to link sexual assault exclusively with this lad culture, because that's suggesting to women that they'll know this demonised person when they see them. Often it's not that obvious. In my case, this is somebody who I seem to have a lot in common with. They seemed gentle, kind, quiet, unassuming, all of that, yet still emotionally manipulated me into doing something I didn't want to do. It can be dangerous to publicise lad culture as the danger, because it blinds people to other dangers that might not be as obvious.
The US film The Hunting Ground looks at how colleges are dealing with cases of sexual assault and rape. Here's a clip.
If a student comes to an administrator with a problem, it's not as if the administrator wants that student to be harmed. It's not as if the administrator wants the harm to be perpetuated. But their first job is to protect the institution from harm, not the student from harm.
The allegation of sexual assault is something that we at the university take very seriously.
ASU issued a statement saying, in part, Arizona State University takes all sexual misconduct complaints very seriously.
The university says it's taking these allegations very seriously.
We take all incidents very seriously.
We take these accusations very seriously.
We take reports like this very seriously.
They take all reports very seriously.
James Madison University takes the safety and well-being of our students very...
The message is clear. It's don't proceed through these disciplinary hearings. No matter what you do, you're not going to win.
An audience member at the Q&A asked this question to Kirby and Amy.
I was just wondering, what was your relationship like with the institutions while you were filming? What kind of access did you have? Did you have problems with that beyond obviously requesting interviews? And then since you've made the film, what's that been like? Because I'm sure that that's a huge, I mean, hunting ground for your campaign, right? So have they been receptive to that, or are they sort of phasing you out?
Well, when we were making the film, for the most part, we were operating under the radar. You know, it was almost impossible. I mean, I think we did go to a few schools and ask them to participate in the filming process, and it was categorical, no. I mean, this did not surprise us. So we decided to kind of directly contact the students and just work with them directly. And then to get a lot of the student of the footage that you see, I mean, you can go on college campuses and shoot yourself, but since we had such a wide range of colleges we were covering, we actually worked with a lot of student filmmakers who were actually on the campus to get a lot of this. You know, these demonstrations were just popping up. I mean, we'd hear about them a few hours before we'd find a shooter on that campus. So it's kind of crowdsourced in that way. Afterwards, I mean, it's been positive and negative. I mean, the positive is shown on more than 550 colleges and universities. That's, I think sometimes the schools aren't quite aware what they're buying into in a way, because but what happens is there's somebody on that campus who's known this has been a problem for a long, long time, that hasn't been listened to or doesn't have enough power to change things. And they bring in this film, and that starts activating things. And we've seen that again at campus after campus. It's shown on more than 60 high schools. But we've also seen, you know, pushback from schools and ways to marginalize it. We saw that here. We saw that in the UK.
Oh, yeah, the first one of the schools that I spoke out, we're doing a little campus tour here, and the professor apologized to me at the start saying, I had wanted to show this in a much bigger venue so there'd be more people here for you, but the administration told me I had to just keep it as an in-class screening just for my class, which is pretty surprising. They didn't want this.
But it isn't that surprising. I mean, that's the reality, is that there are strong forces fighting against this becoming discussed on campus, because if it starts being discussed, then survivors come forward. You know, they might go public, they might go to the police, and then their school becomes associated with this issue. It already is associated. The way to address this is to be transparent about it and to be accountable for it, and then change can happen.
So what did the viewers think of The Hunting Ground? We spoke to some of them after the screening.
Before I came tonight, I wasn't really aware of the issue of kind of rape on campus and sexual assaults on campus. Not really to the extent that it happens. It's just something that's kind of overlooked, but it was kind of distressing to see the extent that it happens in the US. And as well, obviously, the fact that it's the same over here in the UK. Seems kind of like it's a culture that's almost funded by universities and by sports organisations and kind of encouraged. That's really depressing.
I've known of this statistic. I think it's a huge problem that a lot of people are now starting to get recognized, and there's been some great campaigns in the United States, such as the It's On Us campaign, and I think it's helping to raise awareness. I think that this film really kind of helped put into perspective like the human stories and how powerful they really are, and that they're no longer just statistics, but they're emotional, powerful stories that you can relate to, and seeing that it's not just a person, but it's your friend or could potentially be you, as we heard from some people in the audience. And I think going forward, one thing that I really want to do is two calls of action. Number one is contacting officials of like wanting to ensure like legislation continues to get passed, both probably in the United States and the UK. And number two is realizing the power that potentially coaches or sports can have in setting a good example, because they're not only seen as role models, but also have powerful influence. And I think if they're like setting the stage, that could actually be extremely powerful, not only in the sports community, but hopefully infiltrated to like the rest of the student body.
I asked the producer, Amy Zurich, how come the film's protagonists, Annie and Andrea, were able to build such a powerful campaign, and whether they were the first to speak out in such a big way.
No, women and men have been speaking out about this for decades, but I think what the big difference is that's happening now is that you have the internet and social media. And I mean, you even see that in our film where survivors are Skyping each other and trading notes and getting information. And I think that the ability for people to talk to each other from their private space in a safe way has allowed them to sort of form this incredible support network and then feel very empowered about going forward and being public about this assault, you know, what's happened to them, and also able to sort of, you know, strategize about how they can, you know, do activities together to, you know, affect change in a really strategic way. So I think that's what's really allowed women and men like Annie and Andrea to be leading this movement that we're now seeing in the States, which really has incredible sort of grassroots support. And I want to say also that the film, while we highlight Annie and Andrea and they're incredible, there's like dozens like of incredible activists we could have also profiled. You know, you obviously in a film obviously have to just sort of hone it down to two, a small set of protagonists. But, you know, it's not only Annie and Andrea, it's like dozens and dozens of really extraordinary people that are doing this work on the ground every day now in the United States.
Yeah. And I think what's new about what these activists are doing is looking at it as a national problem, as something that is not just school based. It's not just perhaps one case on one school or two or three schools where this is a problem. They saw this the same kind of pattern of cover up repeated again and again at institution after institution. And again, what Amy was saying about social media, they were able to connect and really connect the dots and see that this was a national problem. And I think that has changed the discussion, certainly in the U.S., around this issue.
Hi, my name's Julie. Thank you so much for sharing this story here. You had a high-profile American football player that is obviously depicted here in the film, and I was wondering if there's been any retaliation or any consequences that have happened to Erica or any of the other people that have spoken out in this film, or things that you saw come unexpectedly.
You know, Erica, this is the only time she's spoken out publicly, but if you follow the comments, I mean, you see the trolls and the viciousness of the comments against her. Just again and again and again, every time there's a news story around this story. So as far as I know, I don't think she's personally experienced anything, but it's been very, very hard on her. And she's been, you know, very supportive of the film, and she's very glad that she's been in the film. But coming forward and speaking about this is a very difficult thing. And when we presented the film at a movie theater in Tallahassee, there was a Q&A that followed, and it was several hundred people in the room, and somebody stood up and said, this is about a year and a half after, you know, the story broke, and this person said, this is the first time I've heard Erica Kinsman's name spoken about in a positive light in Tallahassee in a year and a half. So that's what it's like to come forward and speak about this. So, but I think the reason she's been able to be in the film, to come forward, is because she has a very incredibly supportive family. I mean, it's just very interesting. They you know, they travel together. You know, when they come to an interview, there's several of them, and they're just very supportive, and it's kind of wonderful to see.
Back to my chat with Karen McVeigh, senior reporter at The Guardian. I asked her about the differences in the way that UK universities and US colleges respond to allegations of sexual assault and rape.
One of the big differences that I was quite struck by is they were talking about this protection, that they had a lot of voices from the faculty or whatever saying we protect the universities because of money, because of the money that we get in from the fraternity systems. And you saw a lot of figures in there about universities, you know, so many rapes and nobody expelled or one person expelled. However, in the UK, we're not even counting the rapes or sexual assaults. We don't even know how many there are. And we haven't got to the position where you can interrogate a university and whether or not it's covering it up and whether or not they're expelling people, because we haven't even got to that very basic stage, because our research has shown that at least amongst the elite universities which we looked at, less than half of them were properly counting any allegations of rape and sexual assault. So we don't have those figures. And that's something that obviously The Guardian wants to change, because they think that universities should count allegations.
Yeah. Why is it that they don't then? I mean, what happens if somebody reports an allegation of sexual assault or rape? Is it just sort of get lost if nothing happens? Or
there is a policy in a lot of universities where they will not investigate. There were guidelines set 20 years ago by a guy called Professor Zelick, who basically, it was after a rape case, and he set these guidelines saying that universities should not investigate serious crimes, including rape, and this was a matter for police. But some people have argued that this position has led to universities kind of sticking their heads in the sand and kind of saying, oh, you know, these aren't really a matter for us, they're a matter for police, so we don't really want to deal with
the university needs to, you know, obviously criminal matters are for the police, but surely a university needs to protect its students counting.
Yeah, exactly. So that
allegations would help with that.
So kind of part of our argument is that you don't know how big of a problem you have unless you count it. And how are you providing a duty of care to students if you are not counting something that happened, that we know happens to, you know, 1 in 7 women and students, serious sexual assault or physical assault. And if we're not counting it, how do you know, and how can you therefore help your students?
I wanted to know whether the Hunting Ground film has had an impact on the way that people are talking about rape and assault in the US. Is there less shame associated with it? Here's what director Kirby Dick said.
I think there is. I mean, I think people are more willing to come out and speak publicly. I think rather than coming out and speaking about from a position of pain, which they all do, but there's also kind of an anger, righteous anger, a justified anger that they're speaking. They're demanding that the school be held accountable, and not just that this happened and I was mistreated, but this school has to change. And of course, you saw that, I think, in the, you know, dozens of protests that were going on, you know, dozens and dozens that were going on around the United States and still are, and many of which we documented. People have, I think, shifted from this happened to me and it shouldn't have to this. These schools should not be allowing this to happen and certainly should not be covering it up.
And also, I'd say that many of the people that I reached out to for this film, The Hunting Ground, said that they only were comfortable speaking to me because they'd seen Invisible War, which was interesting. So I didn't know it at the time, or we didn't know, but it actually, that's interesting that, like, that film, who knew? Like, it had this sort of ripple effect and this empowering effect that then led others to talk about their own experience, which happened somewhere else, but now then we could sort of make a film about that institution. So it's been actually quite cool and also quite interesting to see how now the discourse has definitely changed around assaults in the military in the U.S. in a way that it did not happen before our film. And I know that we can credit the student movements had a huge impact in changing the discourse around this issue, but I think our film helped sort of leverage and push that even further. I think this is actually an easy problem to fix. It just, A, has to be understood and acknowledged and then has to be dealt with. There's no shortage of money on American campuses, and certainly not on the schools that are highlighted in our film, even though it's a problem everywhere. The problem is just sort of where they're allocating their resources and what they're taking as a priority and important. So the money's there. It's what they're choosing to do with the money. And the second part of the money part is, obviously, schools are incentivized to cover this up because they don't want to alienate donors. They want to protect a brand and have a PR campaign. So in that respect, there's the fear factor that's inhibiting schools from acting properly and allocating money properly. So it's not that the problem's so huge, we don't have the money, we can't fix it. It's totally fixable. But the problem is that schools are, unfortunately, don't really understand this issue, and then figure if they understand it and acknowledge it, it's a liability and a financial liability, and that's keeping them from, you know, taking action. That's the crux of the problem. It's the need for all of us as a culture to reframe and re-understand this issue. And what I like to say is it needs to start be seen as a crime like any other. Like, take sex out of the equation, because that seems to sort of confuse and complicate people, and just understand it as a violent crime. And as such, we should treat it as we would any other violent crime. And what do we have that statistically and supports that is that 92 to 98% of the time, studies show that when someone reports a rape, they're telling the truth. And that's statistically consistent with every other crime in our society. And yet this is the only crime that when you report, they think it's he said, she said, they're not really sure, they want to know what you were drinking, what you were wearing, there's skepticism. You're met with all these layers that confuse the person reporting, confuse and debilitate them, and also allow the crime to sort of go on with to be perpetrated with impunity over and over again, because there's no sanctions ever put in place to the perpetrators. And that's why you see the epidemic levels. It isn't that all the lads and the lad behavior are committing these crimes, as you even say in your film, but they give cover, the culture gives cover, and I guess a hall pass to these crimes being committed by the few that will commit them, because A, it refuses to understand and recognize it for what it is, and B, doesn't have proper mechanisms in place to properly investigate, adjudicate, and prosecute these crimes. So that's the huge shift. You know, that's the hurdle, you know, that Annie, Andrea, and all of us face as a society for getting anything changed.
If you want to have a look at the Guardian short film, Sex, Lads and Grey Areas, you can find it on our website. And to close, Amy and Kirby's answer to how people can get involved and raise awareness for the issues in their film.
We'd love for everybody to get involved. We have a website, seact.org. And that is a hub of different ideas, different information, a constant news feed, informative on the issue, where you can get involved, how to connect with people, et cetera, et cetera. We have a Facebook page, Hunting Ground, and that's great for people who've seen the film, and survivors are on that, and some of the people in our film are on that, and so you can give them a shout out. Also on our film website and also on See, Act, Stop, there's different legislation that you could support.
Right. And the other thing is, if you're alumni or you're still students, to get involved on your campus. I mean, this is it's a national issue, but it's also a campus-by-campus issue. You know, as we go around even to the UK, we see problems. I was at King's College last night, and I was kind of astonished to learn that these two students were presenting a consent workshop, and they wanted to present consent workshops to different people and different groups at the school. And not only did the school not initiate this, it had to be initiated by the students, but what they told me is that King's College, at least at this point, was unwilling to pay the student facilitators £10 an hour to present this, which is, I think, is enraging. You know, you will see this at every campus. I mean, some are better than others. This is not something we're an expert in, but every person should go back to their school and get involved in this, because this is continuing to happen at every school.
And we have a non-theatrical distributor here, and they, you know, we'd love to host screenings, you know, or invite the film to be shown at, you know, your university or your church group or your book club, you know, and have a screening. I mean, this is the way, you know, that we can get the message out and have conversations afterwards. I mean, that would be a really effective tool as well. Oh, and the last thing I'll say, since everyone's on, so that's on a macro level, and those are ways to get involved. But on a micro level, the one thing everyone in this room can do, and if we all did it, and we model that to others and act that in all our relationships, we'd have a radical transformation on this issue. And that is, first and foremost, believe survivors. Just right there. So with that, you know, I encourage you all to take that with you in your hearts and in your acts. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our individual stories are what makes this a story. Here is the experience of 700 survivors.
And unless something happens, it's not going to change.
There is a revolution happening on campuses across the country. And I'm very hopeful that this really is our watershed moment.
We are fed up with your university.
Assault and harassment, and today we decide that we will no longer tolerate it.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.